What's my most favorite thing to do? To talk. Every week I'll do just that. We'll feature national and international movers and shakers, experts in their fields, and all around interesting people with something more than great to say. No holds barred. We'll tackle every topic imaginable, especially for women over 40. This is Conversations with Sima. Please stay tuned. We'll be talking with a penguin expert, TED speaker, Diane DiNapoli. Diane DiNapoli is the author of the award-winning book, The Great Penguin Rescue, which chronicles her experiences as a rehab manager during the rescue of 40,000 penguins from the Treasure oil spill in South Africa. Diane recently returned from a three-week expedition to Antarctica with Homeward Bound, a leadership initiative for women in science. She is looking forward to returning to Antarctica next year as a Global Perspectives guest speaker for Lindblad National Geographic. So welcome, Diane.
Thanks so much for having me.
Tell me a little bit about your life's journey to your current passion and your interest and passion for both penguins and adventure.
Well, it was sort of a long, circuitous route to getting where I am today, and it's been a pretty unexpected journey. I grew up near the ocean, and I've always had a very deep connection to both the ocean and animals. But I never really knew how to make a career out of my love of animals. So I always wanted to do something to help save endangered species, and I always dreamed of working with dolphins, but those things really didn't seem possible. They seemed more like fantasies. And so I kind of bounced around for a long time. I was a ski bum in Colorado. I was a waitress for a long time. And while I was also working as a waitress, I started a metalsmithing business. So I was selling my jewelry up and down the East Coast. And then at some point, I created a line of endangered species jewelry, and I donated a portion of the proceeds to different environmental groups, and which felt great because, okay, I'm finally doing something to help animals, but it didn't feel like enough. And I eventually went back to school to get a degree that would allow me to work hands-on with animals. Eventually, that led to an internship at the New England Aquarium and to the work that I do today.
So why are you so beset with penguins as opposed to other animals? Because really the fascination must be something we can explore in depth. But tell me about penguins.
I wasn't always obsessed with penguins. I was obsessed with dolphins. But the dolphins actually led me to the penguins. So I actually have not been obsessed with penguins my whole life. In fact, they weren't even on my radar until later in life. What happened was I had wanted to always work with dolphins, and when I was 30, I decided I have to do this, I have to try this. And so I had gone back to school to get an internship working with dolphins, which I did get, but then I had another year of internships, and so I got an internship at the New England Aquarium in Boston in the penguin department. And it was sort of once I got into a wetsuit, climbed down into the exhibit, and I was surrounded by these 70 penguins, they captured my heart. And so that was really how the whole penguin thing began.
So tell me about penguins. What don't I know that I need to learn about?
So from a conservation perspective, 15 of the 18 penguin species are actually listed as threatened, near threatened, or endangered, and their populations are crashing precipitously. On an individual basis, they all have their own personality and temperament. And when you work with them in a zoo or an aquarium, you actually develop individual relationships with different penguins. And they know their names, they will respond and come over when you call to them. And if they don't feel like it, they'll look at you and swim the other way.
Back up.
Yeah.
They know their names?
Yeah. They recognize their names. So we would give them all educational names, and they know and will respond to their names. So even though I haven't worked at the aquarium now in over 10 years, when I go in to visit and they hear my voice, they recognize it, and if I call their name, they will turn their head and call back or swim over to greet me. So it's kind of cool to be remembered by a penguin. And well, I often do compare them to cats. I think they're very similar in their personality and in their temperament and even in their ability to be trained. They sort of have, I think, a similar level of intelligence, if you want to call that, and independence as well. So they're pretty cool birds, and they're very, very hardy. They're very strong, and they have razor-sharp beaks, and they will bite the crap out of you, and it really hurts because they have really strong jaws. So I always say they're sort of the pit bulls of the bird world.
And how would you know what kind of personalities they had? Meaning one could be funny? Like, what's the nuance that I'm missing?
Well, so, for example, when you said one could be funny, you made me think of Sandcobb, who was the first penguin that I raised. And he was a penguin that we would bring to schools. We had an outreach program to disadvantaged schools in the Boston area. So for, you know, these kids who might not be able to come to the aquarium, we would sort of bring the aquarium or the penguin to them and do an educational program. And he loved the spotlight. He loved the attention. He would stand there and just sort of primp and show off. And he just had this sort of funny personality that was, he really liked human attention. And then there are others, say, who are older and very bonded with a mate who, you know, are really cranky and crabby and will bite you if you put your hand near them. So they all really do have unique personalities. You do get to recognize individuals, even though, you know, they're all black and white. They have subtly different markings or postures or feather markings, but also by sometimes their personality, you could pick out a bird.
I have lived this long and not known this. So in terms of types of penguins, how many penguins are believed to be in existence in the world? And what types of penguins? Is there only one kind of penguin?
Well, there's so much there, but I will give the Cliff Notes version of that. So there are 18 different species. So, you know, say there's all these different dog breeds. You've got German Shepherds, you've got poodles, et cetera. So they're all penguins, but there are 18 different breeds, if you will, or species. And they range from Antarctica up to the Galapagos Islands and everywhere in between. So they're not all cold weather animals. Some live in literally tropical climates, which surprises most people. Most people are not aware of that at all. And then even though, you know, some of these species are very endangered, like the Galapagos penguin, there's only about 1,500 left. For some species, they're very abundant. So in Antarctica, there are some that there are millions. So throughout the world, there are millions of penguins, but they're not all necessarily, their populations aren't necessarily all doing very well right now.
And in terms of global warming, are you seeing a precipitous impact?
Yeah, actually, the two biggest issues for pretty much all penguin species today are global warming and overfishing. And how it is impacting them is that penguins are starving. So what happens with global warming, there's a lot of different things that happen. It can interrupt the food production chain. So, for example, the food web down in Antarctica, most of the penguins there eat krill, which is a small shrimp-like animal. And the krill nurseries, essentially, where the krill grow, are on the underside of the ice shelves. But with those ice shelves melting back faster and not developing as large, the krill fisheries or the krill nurseries are shrinking. So there's less food. And then you have overfishing. So you have a lot of fisheries going down there and scooping up all this krill. So there's less for the penguins to eat. And then also what will happen is that change in the temperature is moving the cold water currents that their food is in further away from their breeding and foraging grounds. And there are a lot of other ways that global warming is impacting different penguin species, but those are sort of the main things. And the good news side is that those two things are actually something that we as individuals do have some power to do something about through the choices that we make with the types of food that we eat, or, you know, the types of cars we drive, or do we recycle, or, you know, what if we pay attention to our personal global footprint, we can hopefully in the long run help penguins and other animals that are relying on the ocean for their food.
So how did you come to be known as the Penguin Lady, and what does that mean you do?
So I was at the aquarium for 9 years, and part of my job was to give presentations. So you'd be in the exhibit in a wetsuit and giving talks to the public. And people would go, look, they'd point, say, it's a penguin lady. And when I decided to leave the aquarium at the end of 2004, it took a while to figure out what I was going to do next. But I eventually decided I'm going to kind of take the penguin show on the road. And when I sat down, I knew I wanted to go to schools and libraries and assisted living centers and teach about penguin biology, behavior, and conservation. And when I sat down to figure out a company name, that just popped out instantly. And, you know, I spent some more time thinking of other names, but that just really fit. And so it has been sort of accidental branding. I was very lucky that March of the Penguins came out just as I was starting my business, and every year, it seems, has been another penguin movie. So it's really, I think it helped me to grow my business because penguins were sort of front of mind for a lot of people. So it's worked out quite well.
I can't help but feel that penguins are a metaphor for your coming out, that somehow your life was really sort of circuitous and that you really were having a hard time finding yourself. And suddenly, through your knowledge of penguins, through the work that you did, it somehow ran parallel or somehow opened up almost like a midlife crisis. Would that be a correct assumption?
I think it's an interesting analogy. I think more than a midlife crisis, it was almost more a coming of age or finding myself.
Mm-hmm.
Because for so long, you know, I had a lot of different interests, but I couldn't decide on what I really wanted to do. And I didn't go back to school until I was 30 or 31 years old to do this. So I call myself a late bloomer. You know, I came by this career a little later in life. And it just took me a while, I think, to gain the confidence and the belief in myself to create something on my own and to really pursue those dreams that I had about the things that I wanted to do. So I think of it more maybe of a coming of age than a midlife crisis.
Mm-hmm. But in reading your bio, you work with marine animals. You've been working on saving threatened species. You published a book. You are a TED speaker. And you visited Antarctica. And yet your life is being shaped by this.
I think what has happened for me is that I've always just sort of followed my heart in everything that I've done. Something captures my interest. And I'm definitely a lifelong learner. I'm very curious. I'm very insatiable sense of curiosity, and once I'm interested in something, I tend to go down the rabbit hole researching it because I want to know everything I can about it. And so I think I've just sort of followed my passion, and it has just led to all these opportunities and all of these doors opening that I never could have expected. I mean, when I left my job at the aquarium, it was a very difficult decision to leave. I did love it, but there were various reasons that I knew it was time for change. I really didn't know what I was going to do next, and I really struggled because I remember thinking so many times, I can't imagine another job out there that's as cool as this job. And now that was 11 years ago, and what has happened in those 11 years is beyond my wildest dreams. I couldn't even have imagined all the things that would take place in the 11 ensuing years. So for me, I think the lesson is, or maybe for others, I think what the lesson is that once you really make a commitment to pursuing what you're passionate about, you know, the world kind of opens up to you as long as you keep open and you keep saying yes to opportunities. I think it's important to remember to keep saying yes.
So let's turn our sights to your expedition to Antarctica. I would say that for the average listener, just merely saying you spent 3 weeks in Antarctica means that you're an adventurer. You're one of very few people to do this. You must be pretty close to other people who are doing this at the same time you are, and I would guess that creates some sort of camaraderie that I hope that you'll explain. But so tell me about the expedition and specifics, but also about where that places you then on this continuum of adventurous human beings in the world who choose to go to Antarctica.
Well, my first trip to Antarctica was 8 years ago, and I had been invited as a guest lecturer on a ship called the Antarctic Dream. And that had been one of my goals, actually, when I started my business, was to be a guest lecturer And I really had my sights on Lindblad, because they're sort of the Rolls Royce of nature expedition. But that was my first trip, and it was amazing. And then 2 years ago, I was on Facebook, and I wish I could remember who posted it, because I'd love to send them a big thank you, basket of flowers and chocolate. But somebody I know posted this application for this thing called Homeward Bound. And what it was a leadership development expedition for women in science from all around the world. And it was to be 3 weeks in Antarctica on this ship. And the intention behind it was to build a network over 10 years of 1,000 female scientists, and to give them the tools and training to have a more powerful voice at the global leadership table, and in particular when it comes to issues like global warming. And that is why Antarctica was chosen as the backdrop for the program, because, you know, global warming is most extreme at the poles. And so we were on this ship called the Ushuaia for 3 weeks. It ended up being 76 women from several different countries around the world, and I really do feel now that I have this network, this sisterhood of 75 new friends and colleagues, and we have been in a lot of very close contact ever since getting off the ship. And a lot of people are developing projects together, and it's just a really exciting opportunity to connect with all these other women that are in different scientific fields, and hopefully together, you know, our voice can have an impact, a positive impact.
So what are some of the fields that they represent, and what would you expect that your collaborative work would achieve?
I mean, it was fields across the spectrum. So there were physicists, neuroscientists, geologists, climate scientists. There was one other penguin person on board, penguin expert. In fact, someone that I met during the Treasure Oil Spill rescue in South Africa, which we haven't talked about, but just briefly, that was the rescue of 40,000 penguins from an oil spill. And so one of my teammates from that was on board this ship as well. There were social scientists, there was a mathematician, a mining expert, sort of every field of science you can imagine. So they didn't necessarily have to be climate scientists, but I think the reason she was reaching out to scientists, what happened was, what sparked this whole idea was the woman who started this, Fabian Zatner. She's an Australian and a leadership expert in Australia. She had been having a conversation with a few women who are scientists in Antarctica, and they were expressing their frustration about the gender difference at the top levels in science, in so many scientific fields. And she went home that night, went to bed, and literally dreamed up Homeward Bound. It literally came to her in a dream. And so I think the idea is to, one, climate change, to hopefully be able to have a voice at that table, but in all of our individual fields, to be able to have the skills and the confidence to be more visible and to be heard.
So tell me a little bit about the Homeward Bound expeditions. Who does them? What do they cost? Is there an age limit?
Fabian Zatner is the person whose brainchild this is and who is running it. And I should have the URL for you. I can't remember the exact URL. I think it's homewardboundprojects.au. And it's 3 weeks in Antarctica, but it's actually a whole year ahead of that. So you start a year out with monthly conference calls, and you're put into project groups, and each team is doing their own project leading up to the expedition. So, for example, I was on the education outreach and mentoring team, and so we came up with our own project even before we got on the boat, and every team was doing that. So it's a lot of work leading up to it, a lot of reading. We took different tests that have to do with emotional intelligence and learning styles. So there's a lot that goes into it even leading up to the trip. And so in terms of the cost, Homeward Bound absorbs about 60% of the cost per individual participant. And then the other part that we are covering is basically the berth on the ship. And so the cost for this next year is $16,000 U.S. dollars. And so a lot of women use crowdfunding or had help from their institutions to raise that money. But really, that is probably half of what you would pay for a berth on a ship going to Antarctica for 3 weeks. So even that, you know, even though it's a big chunk of change, I felt it was worth it. I definitely felt it was worth that investment.
Is there an age limit, and do the Homeward Bound expeditions go anywhere else?
So there, in terms of age limit, it's a good question. I don't know if they have an exact age limit. I can tell you that we had from 24 years old to 61, and they intentionally have it sort of one-third early career scientists, one-third mid-career scientists, and one-third late career scientists, and a few who have even recently retired but are still involved in science education. So it was a really nice demographic and range. I think the youngest was, there were several PhD students. Although I think for this year I've seen that they have some undergrads who are also applying. And so maybe 18, but I don't know if they actually have put a number on the age.
And at the end of the day, will you create a mission statement, or will you put forth your conclusions to the world? What will you do with your work on Moss?
Well, I think Homeward Bound itself has its own mission statement, which is on the website. I think on Moss, it's going to be, I think what's happening is that we are each on our own going to be collaborating with different people. One of the ideas it was almost like scientific networking. So we literally had like a speed dating event at the end. So one of the things we did on board was we did a symposium at sea where each woman, each scientist, got up and did a 3-minute presentation about their work with a 2-minute Q&A afterwards so that we could all learn a bit more about each other and each other's work. And then at the end, we did a sort of a speed dating where you ran around the room and, you know, stuck your number on people's pieces of paper saying, I want to work with you on this, I want to work with you on that, let's talk about this, let's talk about that.
That's amazing.
And so the idea was that we could, you know, make connections with each other privately afterwards if we wanted, or in groups, or however we want to do it. So it's just, and over the next 10 years, the idea is to do this every year for 10 years. That group will grow in size. Obviously, you know, we won't meet all the others in person like we met, but that network, that platform will be there for us to all communicate with each other.
So you mentioned that you're going to Antarctica next year. What are your hopes and dreams for that? And let's even talk further. Where do you see yourself going in the next 10 or 20 years with your work?
So to answer the first part, I'm going back. A week after I returned from Homeward Bound in December, I received an email from Lindblad and National Geographic saying they'd like to hire me to be a guest lecturer on their ship, the Explorer, in Antarctica next February. So, you know, really, really, really excited about that because that has been my goal for a long time. And we're, in fact, talking about a few other expeditions the following year to different locations in Antarctica. So that is a huge, huge thrill. And then in terms of where do I see my career in 10 to 20 years, you're asking that question that my mom always used to ask me when I was a kid, and I never knew how to answer because I always sort of saw like this big blank slate. I tend to think in much shorter time frames. And so, you know, what the next thing, the next goal in front of me is what I tend to focus on. And what I have learned is to sort of, you know, for me, it's let go of the long view because you just never know. You could set your foot on a path and it's going to take you one direction. And you might have had something else in mind, but, you know, for me, it's just always been follow my heart, follow my passion. And that has taken me places that I, unexpected places and always amazing places. So the big sort of life goal, though, is to continue to make a difference for penguins and for the oceans. I mean, it's not just about the penguins. They're an indicator species alerting us to the health of the ocean and the planet. And so there's sort of a bigger picture for me than just the penguins. But I think my long-term goal is maybe start a nonprofit, collaborate with other people, and do what I can to make a difference, to make a positive difference.
What thought would you like to leave the listener with today?
I think for people who are listening who might be maybe a little bit older, like I was, and are thinking there's something more out there, or I've always had this dream, and I haven't pursued it, and I don't know if I can do it, is to find the confidence in yourself. And as something that I did when I was 30, I realized, you know, I'd always had this dream of working with dolphins. I realized I did not want to get to the end of my life and look back and regret that I hadn't at least tried to do it. I may or may not be successful, but I didn't want to have that regret of not having tried and that question mark of what if could I have if I had tried. And so maybe do that little exercise, like imagine yourself at the end of your life, and how would you feel if you didn't at least try? And if the answer is, I'd be crushed, then you got to try it. You got to go for it and do it.
We've been talking today with Penguin expert, TED speaker, and adventurer, Diane DiNapoli. She can be found at www.thepenguinlady.com and at the Great Penguin Rescue. Thank you so much, Diane, for joining me today. This was lovely.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you so much to the listener for joining us. I'm Sima Shapiro, your host of For Women Over 40, Conversations with Sima. And until next time, I hope you take care. As our outro, we'll be hearing from the song Penguins by Lyle Lovett. Take care.
Penguins are so sensitive to my needs.